Good morning. It's Friday, April 24th, and you're tuned in for North Idaho News of the Week. I'm Jack Peterson, and I'm joined by Chris Bessler. Good morning to you, Chris.
Good morning, Jack. Beautiful sunny day out there.
It is. A little chilly, but the frost is thawing, and it is a beautiful sunny day. It looks like it's supposed to be a nice weekend, too.
Yeah, it's going to be cool, but sunny.
Yeah. And also in the room with us is Zach Hagedon, the editor-in-chief of the Sandpoint Reader. Good morning, Zach.
Good morning, Jack. Good morning, Chris. Mm-hmm.
It's nice to have you here, and we've got a roundup of the news of the week for you. I'll start with some headlines. At the state level, we have three ballot measures approaching the signature deadline on Friday, May 1st, that have officially been approved to compete for a spot on the ballot. They wouldn't appear on the ballot until November, but the deadline for collecting the minimum 70,000 signatures from across the state to qualify for the ballot is approaching. They have to submit these signatures to the Idaho Secretary of State by Friday, May 1st. That's two marijuana legalization efforts and the Reproductive Freedom and Privacy Act. I'll give just a little bit more detail about those, as well as what else we can expect to see on the ballot in November. The Idaho Marijuana Legalization Initiative would legalize the use, possession, and cultivation of marijuana. The Idaho Medical Marijuana Legalization Initiative, which is distinct from the other, would legalize the use of marijuana for individuals diagnosed with a substantial health condition. The supporters of that second have announced that they've received at least the minimum 70,000 signatures and are intending to file with the Secretary of State. I'm not sure about the first one. Also, the Idaho Reproductive Freedom and Privacy Act has announced that they have also received, I think, more than 100,000 signatures. And they count on a certain portion of any ballot initiative counts on a certain portion of those signatures being disqualified for any number of reasons. They could be somebody could sign twice or provide the wrong address or anything like that. So they want to have a cushion. But the Idaho Reproductive Freedom and Privacy Act does seem to have that. And they also intend to file with the Secretary of State. Their act would provide in statute that people have a right to reproductive freedom and privacy, defined as, quote, the right to make and carry out one's own reproductive decisions. This would overturn several of the state's abortion ban laws. Also on the ballot are a couple of Senate and House resolutions that will go to the general populace for an answer. One of them is in response to these, or if not in response, then at least in opposition to the two marijuana initiatives. HJR 4 would provide that only the state legislature has the authority to legalize marijuana, narcotics, or other psychoactive substances. So if that were to pass, the other initiatives would be moot. Also, HJR 6 adds a constitutional language designating English as the official language of Idaho that will be on the ballot in November. And there's an official state question that will be on the ballot in November, asking voters to choose the official state gun of Idaho in the subject of symbols. And I'm not sure if that's a multiple choice question or what. I mean, I imagine will be offered a few different makes and models, and we'll get to determine.
Only the most critical items.
Surely it'll be the Winchester 3030.
We'll see.
Surely.
Yeah. That's coming up on – those three are going to be on the ballot in November, and then the other three, it remains to be seen, but this is the last week and those signatures to be collected and then filed. In other state news, Governor Brad Little has officially lost the support of the teachers union after he signed a bill earlier this month, House Bill 516. The Idaho Education Association, the IEA, issued a vote of no confidence in the Republican governor over this past weekend. Members overwhelmingly supported the motion as part of IEA's delegate assembly, the union's annual business meeting, according to a press release from the IEA. This is, yes, after Little's signature of House Bill 516, which is legislation that heavily restricts the way school districts can accommodate a broad range of union activities, quote, union activities, unquote. IEA President Lane McKinley said in the news release, quote, our members have spoken clearly. They are angry and frustrated with the governor. They feel his choice to sign House Bill 516 when there were so many reasons to veto it is a betrayal of his claims to be a supporter of Idaho's educators and public schools. Little's response came through in a statement through a spokesperson on Tuesday. He pointed to billions of dollars in the transformative investments in public schools that he has supported in recent years. He listed those also in the transmittal letter to the Secretary of State, wherein he signed House Bill 516, despite in that letter he did say that he had some concerns with the bill. Of note, IEA members had endorsed Brad Little in the 2016 general election and during the 2022 primary, Republican primary. Little is running for re-election this year in a crowded primary field, and he will be running without the teachers' union's support. Coming up to North Idaho, well, the lake level, currently observed at 2,054 feet and three quarters above sea level at Hope, which is actually slightly lower than it was last week and lower than it was projected to be. The current projections call for it to come up about half a foot over the next week. In county news, Bonner County, as well as their co-defendants, have prevailed in a RICO case with Mountain Homestead. Hold on. I guess I should say, I don't know if they've do you say they've prevailed if they if they're the defendant and not the plaintiff? But district court judge Amanda Brailsford ruled on April 16th against the residents of the Mountain Homestead development in the federal Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act that was brought against more than 30 entities, which had included Bonner County and the Panhandle Health District. So those that lawsuit will they I guess threw out a number of the claims, but despite the ruling, the defendants still face seven allegations at the state level regarding the creation, construction, and sale of the subdivision Mountain Homestead. We're going to have to talk to the reader Sansre Mitchell about the details of this and I guess where it goes from here, what could possibly happen with that case. But it, for now, anyway, a step in favor of the county and against the plaintiffs who are suing the county and 30 other entities. They've had, I guess, a number of problems with sewage, with drinking water contamination, with road access, and they say that there was a conspiracy to defraud them, more or less, and are suing. Here also in the county, in breaking news, I believe just last night or two nights ago, Joanne Guzzi withdrew from the county clerk's race in an unforeseen turn of events. She has resigned from the race, citing similarities between her candidacy and that of her opponent, Roger Rudd, as the main reason. The announcement was made to the public during a live candidate forum hosted by Bonner County Farm Bureau at the Blanchard Community Center, where candidates running in the upcoming May primary elections were answering a series of questions from the public. And after hearing Rudd's response to one of the questions, Guzzi announced that she was withdrawing from the race. And I don't believe she officially said that she would be endorsing Roger Rudd, but she did say that she felt that there was a certain duplication of effort between her candidacy and Rudd's. Here in Sandpoint, the milling and paving improvement project on Pine Street that had begun last fall is set to resume on May 1st and be completed by mid-May. During daytime hours from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., the street is expected to be fully closed between Pine Street, or on Pine Street is the street that will be closed between Division Avenue and Boyer Avenue. So a major east-west thoroughfare in Sandpoint will be closed to traffic, and that includes close to parking. The project includes improvements to curb ramps, which were completed last fall before winter weather forced the city to put the project on hold. The project will, according to urban forester Eric Bush, the project will increase the lifespan of the asphalt on Pine Street by around 15 to 20 years. Staff report released last October said the project will cost the city $287,596, which is funded by the resort city tax. And coming up on May 4th and 5th at Sandpoint High School, there are candidates forums for those candidates running for county and state office from Legislative District 1 and for county office in Bonner County. We will see Asia Williams as well as her, hold on, where did I put that? The Asia Williams as well
Jeff
as her
Roberts.
Opponent, Jeff Roberts. Let's see. County Clerk Spencer Hutchings and Roger Rudd. We don't expect, I imagine, to see Joanne Guzzi there. And then for the District 1 Commissioner, Steve Smith is running to replace Republican Brian Domke. He's running unopposed for the Republican nomination, but does face a challenger in the general election, an independent Fred Arn. Statewide races, you have in House 1A, Mark Sauter, the incumbent, is facing Jane Sauter, no relation, for the Republican nomination, and Karen Mattei is running for the Democratic nomination for House Seat 1A. House Seat 1B, Cornell Razor, is the incumbent and facing a challenger in Chuck Lohman for the Republican nomination for House Seat 1B. And then the winner of that contest will face Catherine Larson, running as an independent in the general election. And in Senate District 1, Scott Herndon is challenging once again Jim Woodward, the current incumbent, for Senate, State Senate in District 1. And then the winner of the Republican nomination will face Steve Johnson in the general election in November. The primary is coming up on May 19th, and you can check out these forums at Sandpoint High School at 5:30, or you can tune in to KRFY if you want to listen to them, and we'll be also posting those recordings on our website, and there'll be if you're the type who likes to read your news rather than listen to it, well, you can read about it in the Reader or the Bee, I suppose. And that's those are my headlines. Did I miss anything before we start talking a little bit about the kind of the state of the race? Did I anything jump out at you that I forgot to talk about?
Kind of a slow week for news.
I thought so too.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit of a respite from.
Well, it's going to get a lot more newsy.
Yeah.
In the next couple of weeks, so maybe that's a good break.
Yeah, and I was thinking, you know, as we kind of scheduled our Friday news show, this might be the only chance we have, kind of the break in the ongoing cycle of news where we can kind of take a breath and talk about just what's going on in local politics
and wildly speculate
and who better than
I'm your man for wild speculation.
Okay.
Factually based, I hope.
Yes, factually based
when appropriate.
Let's see, we want to talk, of course, about the local races and largely about the local races, but let me start on the statewide level, because you do have You are our man who spent some time in Boise covering the news down there. Does Brad Little face any serious challenge for the Republican nomination or for the or in the general election for the governor's seat?
I think the easy answer is no.
Yeah.
Brad Little is such an establishment politician down there from his time in the legislature as a lawmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And then as lieutenant governor and now as governor, that I think he's pretty unassailable. The internal politics of the Idaho Republican Party is another thing. So, I mean, if you're talking about like opposition from a Democrat or sort of a challenger in the election, no, but within the party ranks, potentially, yes. And I think that that might speak to his sort of running afoul of the teacher union.
Mm-hmm.
There are, of course, elements within the Idaho GOP at the state party level that have made it their life's mission to chip away at public education, especially teacher unions and union bargaining power and just sort of generally the funding of public education.
Yeah.
I mean, the Idaho Freedom Foundation itself, you know, sort of the right wing think tank lobby group, whatever you want to call them, have come right out over the years and said, like, the state should not be in the education business. So as a voice and as a power within sort of the Republican ecosystem at the state level, that pressure has always been there.
Mm-hmm.
And Little over the years has been kind of a cipher, a little bit Sphinx-like perhaps, in his approach to the IFF. He kind of keeps them at arm's length, but also recognizes that they have influence through their sort of rating and scorecard system that they have for elected officials.
Yeah.
Whether or not they align with their freedom agenda, liberty agenda, whatever they want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
But seeing Brad Little, who has really pinned himself on the board as a pro-education Republican over the years, to see him kind of move in that direction illustrates to me, as I wildly speculate, but mm-hmm. based in fact, that he's feeling that pressure from that wing of the party.
Yeah.
Maybe more than he has in the past and is playing to that.
Yeah, Zach, you know, so he's got, I think, 7 opponents in the Republican
right.
primary, which is... That's kind of a gift to an incumbent
mm-hmm.
because
yeah.
it splits up the
right.
opposing vote so much. But are there any of those guys like a main challenger to him that you know of?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, yeah. The way it works down there is there's people have turns, right? I mean, like you take turns, like who's going to be the governor next? Who's going to be the lieutenant governor next? Like there's a pipeline that exists within sort of the party infrastructure. And most of the folks who are running against Little, if they're not unknown, then they are sort of fringe characters. I don't even remember the name of Fitzpatrick, right? Isn't that one of them?
Yeah.
He's the one who has the most name recognition, and it's
Mark Fitzpatrick. Yeah.
And it's entirely because of culture war, you know, headline grabbing stuff like the hetero awesome day that he hosted at his bar,
mm-hmm.
And you know, stuff like that. So, I mean, he's more of a noisemaker than anything. But Little is the guy who's going to win. And I think everyone knows that, but it indicates to me that he's playing more to that sort of harder right wing portion of the Republican Party. And he's taken his licks from that side of the party over the years, especially during COVID when he had some lockdown orders and he followed a lot of the directives of the federal government, the CDC, about, you know, social distancing and stuff like that, closing down churches. And if you remember back to that time, the right wing of the Republican Party in Idaho went after him, saying that he was, mm-hmm. you know, caving into the feds. I mean, Heather Scott, who was at that time our District 1 representative, until the Jerry or the until they did the redistricting, and she
yeah.
claims mm-hmm. gerrymandered her out of our district.
But she's still in there in District 2.
District 2 now.
Yeah.
But I mean, she called him Little Hitler.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he has taken it from that side of the party pretty hard.
Yeah.
But I think it's indicative of sort of a rightward trend in the party overall, from the state level down to the local level, where you really have, instead of opposition from a Democratic direction, you have opposition within the party itself.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of this jockeying for, like, who's a true conservative, who's an actual member of the Republican Party, who's not a rhino, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that colors the entire primary,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Shouldn't neglect to mention there are 4 candidates for the Democratic governor's nomination. And among them are Terry Pickens, Maxine Durand, Jill Kirkham, and Chanel Torres. Among those, do you see a leader?
Terry Pickens, I think, has probably got a better shot of at least making the headlines.
He seems to be. I'm seeing more campaign literature from
more established campaign.
Yeah,
probably better ground game. I mean, if you're talking like Republican versus Democrat at the state level, I think the only race worth watching for competitiveness is maybe the superintendent of public instruction.
Mm-hmm.
Lauren Nekachia, she's the head of the Idaho Democrats at the state level, has said, you know, like this is the only seat in the constitutional officers of the state that the Democrats have held in the past.
Mm-hmm.
It's the one that they do the best at.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got a candidate,
Becky Sundin,
who's going to be in town here for a meet and greet and a teacher appreciation event, running against Debbie Critchfield, who's the incumbent. And that might be the only thing that comes close to being competitive. I think maybe some of the congressional races, the Fulcher race, that one's got a little more heat to it than the other ones. And that's Kaylee Peters.
Yeah.
She's a Democrat running in that one. And she's run before. And she's got name recognition, and I think that she runs a good campaign. And at least there'll be a conversation about that race. not to say that I think that Republican voters are not going to turn out for Fulcher, but he's I don't know how popular he is, to be honest. I mean, he never comes up here.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, yeah, that I do find it interesting that Governor Little facing such a crowded field where, the incumbent has such a great advantage. I guess this is really just emphasizing the point you made. But, you know, he has painted himself as a friend to education. I mentioned before that he received the support of the IEA in 2022, last time he ran for governor. This bill was not, it wasn't a slam dunk. He had the opportunity to stop Bill 516 altogether. And there were a number of, he could have said for any number of reasons that he did so, including the process by which it got to, just on a process question, he could have said, I'm in favor of all this, but not the way that it got to my desk, which is through significant amendments in the Senate after it had passed in the House.
Right.
I don't know.
If he wanted to align himself with teachers in education, it seemed like a pretty easy veto to make.
Right.
And he couldn't have been overridden because the legislature was out of session by that point.
And he's set his own, he set a personal record for vetoes already this year. He vetoed six. Well, if you include line item vetoes, he vetoed six bills altogether.
I think that speaks also to what I was sort of alluding to, that there's a lot of tension within the party. So that's him sort of exerting his executive privilege over the legislative branch. And that's another theme that's been ongoing since at least the COVID era, where elements within the legislature have pressed really hard for, limiting the executive power, like limiting the governor's ability to sort of run roughshod over whatever they decide. So that's sort of a sideline conflict maybe that they have between, sort of the legislative supremacists. I don't know. I mean, the ones who feel like the legislature should be above the governor, and then the governor like reminding them, like, I am still the boss, here in the legislative or the executive side.
Yeah.
And that feeds into sort of the internal partisanship of the Republican Party in Idaho, where you've got the hard right and then sort of the less hard right.
Yeah.
And you can't forget that none of this ever happens in a vacuum. We have the federal level. The Trump administration is losing support among a lot of voters for, stuff like cost of living, the Iran war, Epstein file, you name it. I mean, like the Trump administration is having a hard time with its messaging and holding on to its sort of hardcore base. And I think that cognitive dissonance that exists at the federal level trickles down into the state level to where people who've really hitched their star to Trump, like, Little has made no secret of currying favor with the White House. He's always trying to get a favorable retweet or some kind of, statement from Trump about how great he is. Same with our congressional delegation. They're always trying to curry favor at the White House. And to see sort of softening of support for the Trump administration at the federal level kind of puts a fear into sort of these state level officials who have aligned themselves in that way. So it's almost like you double down, mm-hmm. you know, and just hope.
I get the sense they feel fairly invulnerable in this right. particular state. Mm-hmm. But who knows? I mean, and maybe there could be some repercussions in the Fulcher race. It'll be interesting to see if that race does become more competitive.
Well, Fulcher's going to, again, putting on my wild speculation hat, Fulcher's going to double down on this notion of the no tax on tips thing, because that was his legislation in Congress. And Trump has made it a big deal as well, that this is like a major piece of primary red meat for the base voters. And I anticipate you'll hear a lot about that from Fulcher. And if Kayleigh Peters is smart in her campaigning, she will point out that it's not exactly as great as it looks. when you consider the fact that we have, you know, loss of revenue and that it still doesn't touch the minimum wage issue. So, yeah, you can not tax people on their tips, but they're still not getting paid anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and how do we refill that revenue loss, you know, taxes elsewhere?
Mm-hmm. Locally, we have some closely watched races, not just locally, but statewide. Once again, is it safe to say that the contest between Jim Woodward and Scott Herndon is one of the kind of bellwethers of politics in the state?
Always. Yeah. At least for the past four times they've faced off, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they keep...
That's the fourth time.
And I don't think... It's never been more than about 55-45, I think. I can look that up while we're sitting here.
Well,
it's always close.
Both in their campaign funding and in their ultimate vote totals, they're always within a couple of, you know, pretty slimish margin.
A few percentage points, a matter of, yeah.
Yeah, like I just took a look at the funding in this race. Same here. Yeah. And they're $82,000 and $84,000.
It's like a $1,000 difference.
Yeah, it's not much. And last election cycle, 2024, they were the most expensive race in the legislative race in the state. They each raised over $100,000.
And I think it was the most expensive primary race in Idaho history, you know, for legislature.
Yeah. And, you know, we still got a ways to go, so they could top $100,000.
Yeah, it was like 170 something thousand, I think, for the last time.
Yeah.
But that's also one of those cases of, you know, the right wing versus the less right wing. You know, that they illustrate, I think, the tensions within the Idaho Republican Party generally.
Yeah. What are the consequences here? Where we know that they're vastly different rhetorically, but we're not electing a president. You know, we're talking about a state Senate seat. What are the consequences of who wins, if it's throwing out the what comes in the general election, but just if the contest is between Scott Herndon and Jim Woodward, what's the difference for a resident in North Idaho? What do they see when, you know, depending on who their state senator is?
We're in kind of a unique situation up here in District 1 in that, traditionally speaking, our senator has been a powerful member of the Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the most powerful committee in the legislature. It's the one that sets the budget and then sets the budgets for everybody else in the state. And, you know, we had Sean Keogh as our senator for many years, and she was an integral part of JFAC. And then that sort of passed down to Jim Woodward, and Woodward is a very involved member of JFAC as well. So, and Herndon, during his one term that he served as our senator, he was also on JFAC. So whoever we're sending down there to Boise is going to have this sort of front row sort of guiding hand position on how the budget is set. And this past session and the session next year are assuredly going to be filled with budget stuff. I mean, the budget was the number one story of the past legislative session because of the huge tax cut that was pushed through in, was it 2024, 25, 24, that hollowed out a bunch of our income. Like, we had a revenue shortfall, like $250 million that we had to fill. At the same time as the Trump administration and the Congress passed through that one big beautiful bill, which required tax conformance by the states, we didn't account for that. So we had a one of the most fraught budget cycles I think that I've ever seen watching the legislature over 20 some years.
And they ended up basically with an across the board cut.
Right.
4%, 5% starting fiscal year 27.
And that's really the beginning of what we're going to deal with next year. And we've been warned repeatedly by people like Senator Woodward and Representative Mark Sauter that this is like a sign of things to come. So if Herndon prevails in the primary, makes it through the general and becomes our District 1 senator, he'll be the one handling that issue instead of Woodward. And Woodward's taken a much more circumspect,
I'd say pragmatic.
Pragmatic
approach. You got to have money to fund things like, you know, highways and education.
While Herndon is making a big campaign push in this particular primary to eliminate the entirety of property taxes.
Property tax. So, and he contends that money goes mostly to, or entirely actually, to local governmental units.
Right.
And he contends that, well, the state can make that up. And he's got some math that he's got for that. And
it remains to be seen if that math maths.
Yeah, I'm not in a position to judge that.
I'm not good at math, but I do know that it's a very heavy lift and a big promise to say we're going to eliminate an entire category of taxation. It's never really been proposed in Idaho. Yeah.
It would no question shift some burden onto local,
right.
To local governmental units.
Well, like, education is also funded very heavily through property taxes. Right. So that's part of that other sort of through line that we were referring to, you know, that there's an effort to sort of eliminate public education.
And 80% of the school districts in Idaho have to pass supplemental levies.
Right.
To make their budgets. So it's the whole education system is heavily reliant on property taxes.
And I personally wonder how far such a proposal would get, you know, in reality, assuming that, you know, Scott Herndon is our senator after the general and he's in the state house. I'm trying to imagine a scenario where he brings a bill saying we're going to eliminate property tax. Like, how far is that actually going to get? Or is it one of these kind of like running for student council, you know, in high school and be like, I'm going to replace all the water with root beer and the drinking fountains.
Yeah, everybody gets ice cream on Friday. Yeah.
I mean, how realistic is this actually?
That it would pass down there.
Right.
Yeah. But one thing about Herndon, he put a whole bunch of bills in his one term.
Mm-hmm.
He crafted a bunch of legislation and I think a couple of them passed.
Yeah. And, you know, his website's replete with his record. Mm-hmm. People can look that up. But I would say that, to your question, Jack, like, what is it? What are the ramifications, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, you know, Jim Woodward, we already know what he would do probably at JFAC, and that was that he's going to continue to try to solve this budget issue, and he won't be the kind of guy who's going to be like, let's eliminate taxes, whereas Herndon's going to, you know, push his no property tax thing, and we'll be curious to see how that fits with the general issues facing JFAC.
How that plays out in this election we have coming up, May 19th.
Yeah.
We're kind of out of time here, guys.
It's true. So yeah, we're past our allotted time. It goes awfully fast. We should, I guess. What more to ask about? I mean, the organization is such that we don't have any, or we now no longer have any three-way races now that Joanne Guzzi has dropped out of the the county clerk's race. So it's head-to-head all the way down. Is there any particular race here or else, you know, statewide or anywhere that you're looking at most closely? We don't have any polling up here.
Right.
We have no idea how these races are going. So when you know, looking ahead to this primary, what are you looking at to glean the most information from? What's going to tell us the most?
The clerk's race was the one that I was really most interested in. But now that we've got, you know, Joanne Guzzi dropping out unexpectedly like that, I think that race becomes a little clearer, like how it's going to end up. I mean, Rudd's already got the endorsement of the Bonner County Republican Central Committee. He has the endorsement of Mike Rosedale, the outgoing clerk of like 12 years, who is generally well-respected, you know, by the community. the internal politics, yet again, are the things that fascinate me the most. I mean, the BCRCC is really kind of at itself. Like, the knives are out, you know, sort of internally with the Central Committee. Anybody who follows kind of the wonky inside baseball stuff knows that there are two main factions within the Central Committee. There's the Politically Activated Christians is the name of the group, and that's sort of the Herndon camp. And they're going after the other group, which I don't know. They don't have a fancy name that I know of, but there are precinct committee members who are tired of, I guess, the Herndon sort of faction of the party.
That's been really controlling the committee.
It's been controlling the committee
for some number of years.
Yeah, picking the endorsements, you know, putting out the voters' guide.
Yeah. Used to be that these central committees would not endorse in the primaries.
Right.
They let the voters decide who they want to elect, and then they support that candidate in the general election. But, you know, we're in a different climate now,
right,
because these races are pretty much decided in the primary.
We've seen the precinct committees become the most important game in town, really. Yeah. And it's something that nobody ever really talked about.
And there's a bunch of contested Republican precinct
races. For the first time in a long time. Yeah. And that's really, I think, the real race.
Mm-hmm.
You can talk about, you know, the Herndon Woodward. You can talk about the clerk's race.
Well, the Asia Williams Jeff Roberts race. That seems like that's gonna be pretty competitive,
right? But
she's the incumbent. But Jeff Roberts is the one that's being supported by the Republican Central Committee,
right? And so that's where you really have to look for the politics. Is like, who did the Central Committee endorse in the primary, and that's where the battle lines are being drawn. And Herndon is running a race as much against Woodward as he is against these other precinct committee members, because he had to step down from his chairmanship to run for Senate. So if he loses the Senate race and these precinct committee races go against him, then he's going to be basically out of political
disenfranchised
power. He'll still be a precinct committee member, but he won't be, you know, the big boss of the party anymore. So that's, I think, this sort of like behind the scenes sleeper race is all these precinct committee seats. And there's like, I think 23 people running or something. It's crazy.
A lot of precinct people. I will mention that on Wednesday, the 29th coming up, we do have interviews with Scott Herndon and Woodward that we're going to be airing on the morning show, 8 a.m. And then the two subsequent Wednesdays, we will be covering the candidates for Commissioner District 2 and the county clerk. So listen for those, folks.
Okay. Yeah. Local decision 2026.
Yeah. Mark May 4th and 5th on your calendar to catch the forms.
Sparks may fly. That could be good. That'll be fun to listen to, and for those who attend in person, I'm sure it'll be good to see and meet the candidates. Thanks for sticking with us here as we've gone long over our time, as we so often do. And let's get into Otto's Eclectic Mix. Let's play something by The Who to kick things off. Zach, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And you can read his musings in The Reader this week on Newsstands Now. Thanks again for listening to North Idaho News of the Week.